This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Unlocking the human genome was a tremendous accomplishment, and it really didn't happen that long ago. Scientists can now map your unique genetic fingerprint, so to speak, paving the way for personalized healthcare and perhaps some high-tech identity theft.
So in some instances, they actually could come up with the exact identity of who that sequence really belonged to, just based on this information.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the challenges of maintaining privacy in the information age. Then we'll hear about students going beyond the borders of their own country to find a college or university. And we'll spend an academic minute with a look at the struggle between ecotourism and heavy industry. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Science says that no one besides yourself has ever been born or ever will be again with your precise DNA sequence, unless you're an identical twin, and even then, maybe not so much. So a complete DNA sequence precisely identifies a person, and a recent paper has shown that a real breach of privacy is feasible with access to just limited genomic data, bare-bones demographic information, and publicly available internet tools. Here to help us take a look at the risks and the non-risks of genetic testing on your privacy is Dr. Bruce Korf, a medical geneticist and chair of the Department of Genetics at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. We spoke earlier this year, and I asked Dr. Korf just what's going on here. How can the identity of a person who has his genome sequence be discovered?
What was done here is the group began with some publicly available genome sequences. There have been some people who, with appropriate permission, had agreed to put their genome sequences into a place where others can see them. They then used that to reconstruct some sequence patterns on the Y chromosome. So that means they were using sequences from males. And there are a certain number of Y chromosome sequences that have been inherited as blocks of DNA through human evolution. And there are several such blocks that distinguish different groups of individuals that migrated to different parts of the world over the course of human history. They could figure out from the sequence which particular blocks of Y chromosome DNA these various males who had been sequenced had. And then they went to a database that exists of Y chromosome sequences that are attached to surnames, because at least in Western societies, the surname, the last name, tends most of the time to be inherited, you might say, from the father. These surnames tend to travel with the Y chromosome, in effect. And these databases have been used by people as kind of a way to track ancestry. Somebody will put their Y chromosome sequences in or get those tested. Their names are known, and their hope is that they'll get linked to other people who share those same sequences who may be distant relatives, potentially. So there's a fair amount of data now on these Y chromosome sequences and the corresponding last names. So when they put these publicly available Y sequences into the database, they could figure out, in some cases, what the last names might be. Now, in some of those, the last names were not unique, and so they really couldn't come up with much. And in some cases, the last names could have been very, very common, like Smith, for example, and that doesn't narrow things down too much. But in a handful of cases, they actually found last names that were fairly unique and correlated well with the Y chromosome sequence. And then in many of these cases, very, very general information was available, like year of birth and the city where the individual resides. And in a handful of cases, they could actually take the last name, the year of birth, and the city and narrow it down to one or to very few people. So in some instances, they actually could come up with the exact identity of who that sequence really belonged to just based on this information. So that's really what was done here.
Well, does the risk of breach of privacy apply to anyone who has genetic testing performed?
So no, it does not, certainly not at this point in time. When genetic testing is done these days, it is usually done in a very targeted way. One has a particular clinical question in mind, and the way to answer that question is to determine the sequence of a particular gene of the 22,000 or so. And so you're not looking at all the Y chromosome sequences that this group looked at. You're really just taking a very, very tiny chunk of the genome. Now we are beginning to use what is called exome sequencing. And so that means to look at the 1.2 or so percent of the genome that actually directs the synthesis of proteins. And it does make it possible to do a genetic test without a prior knowledge of what particular gene you might be interested in. But even that does not target the Y chromosome sequences that were used in this study. In some cases now, and probably more and more in the time to come, the potential for doing the whole genome, which then would include the Y chromosome, does exist. So, of course, theoretically, if that all happened, you could do the same thing. Of course, the other point to realize is that most people, when they do genetic testing, are not putting their genome data into the public domain. It exists inside of clinical laboratories that have strict privacy rules about the sharing of any of the information. So even if you had your whole Y chromosome sequence determined as part of a clinical test, it would not be sitting there open to the public for anybody to query your identity with. So in short, no, I don't believe that these risks apply to those that have clinical genetic testing.
What are some of the potential risks of having someone's identity revealed following genome sequencing?
Well, the first point may be to state what the risks are not, because I guess it's important to remember that there are privacy laws in place and these offer significant protection. So, for example, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act would prohibit the use of genetic information, including genetic testing, gene sequence, actually even things like family history, prohibits the use from being incorporated into employment decisions or health insurance decisions. So that means eligibility for health insurance or the setting of rates or anything. So those are off the table as risks. There could be risks of having your identity known in terms of things like life or disability insurance that are not covered under GINA, life insurance in particular. I suppose it's possible if a life insurance company figured out who you were from doing this, that they could, in principle at least, use that information to make a decision. And I don't think there's any law right now that would prohibit that. You know, so in general terms, what are the risks? They're probably, I mean, if it were the case that your genome sequence really was in the public domain and somebody traced it back to you, the risks would probably be tangible ones of life insurance discrimination, I guess, and potentially stigmatization. Somebody could decide that you're at risk for something. They might or might not be interpreting the data correctly, but you wouldn't have much control over that. And so it could theoretically be used to sort of invade your privacy in one way or another. I think the whole issue hinges on how widely you're willing to make your sequence information available if you're concerned about those kinds of risks. But again, the risks are there, definitely, but there are many protections that need to be kept in mind as well.
Well, knowing what we now know about genomic privacy, or lack of it, will this interfere with future genomic sequencing research?
Certainly there is the potential that this could highlight the potential risks and discourage some people from wanting to participate. Obviously, I hope that does not happen, and I think there are good reasons to believe that the risks remain very low in this context, and that's true for several reasons. One is most of the genomic sequencing research does not involve putting raw sequence data in the public domain where anybody can access it. You know, the instances that were used in this paper are somewhat special instances where that's been for whatever reason, sometimes because of the actual expressed desire of the participant, sometimes because of the nature of the study. But it's not typical to put all of this information right out there where anybody can see it. So there should be and are safeguards put in place to ensure the privacy of individuals who participate, actually in pretty much any kind of research, and this would be no exception. So I think people should realize that this was a special case and is not the general case. So that's point number one. I do think it does highlight the importance of reading the informed consent forms and asking questions and making sure one understands what potential risks there could be. This is actually already in consent forms in most cases, I think, that there could be potential risks of breach of privacy because no system is perfect, but here are the safeguards that are being taken to protect against that. And it's important for people to understand that these are not empty words, but yes, there are potential risks, but yes, also there are safeguards in place to try to mitigate them. So if the outcome of this is that people are more alert and they are willing and interested in participating, but with full cognizance of what they're signing into, I don't think that's a bad thing. But I certainly would not want to see the outcome be a kind of a panic that all of a sudden they're signing away their privacy forever, because that really is not the case. And I think people should realize that even here in this study, with the exception of very high-profile, very well-known instances of sequencing, which therefore revealed nothing that wasn't already known, the actual true identities were not made public. They were just known to the investigators. So I really think people should be reassured as much as anything.
Well, finally, Doctor, Let's look ahead. What should be done to better protect the privacy of individuals who have their genome sequenced?
Well, I think the first point is to be clear and open about the potential risks and at the same time the safeguards that have been put in place. So it does highlight the importance of the informed consent procedure and for people to realize that, you know, they're engaging in an activity that's not free of risk. And I don't think anybody would want people to believe that research is totally risk-free. I think it does highlight also to me the importance of there being a partnership between the researcher and the participant. This is not a one-way street where the participant agrees to give some blood or DNA and then the investigator goes off and does what they're going to do with it, and that's the end of their discussion. I do think that there is a reasonable expectation of the participant to be kept in the loop on progress in the research, not necessarily given their own personal results that may or may not be relevant to the reason for the research. And I don't think you want people in a situation where they're expecting information to use to guide their own personal health decisions when the work is really not validated in that way. But I think it's fair for them to know in general terms what's been learned and to be kind of respected as a participant where there is some feedback as to how valuable the participation was and the kinds of insights that resulted from it. So keeping people informed and keeping them engaged, I think, is a good thing. And knowing that people are facing some potential risks, they need to feel that they have confidence in the people that they're working with. And I believe that comes from perceiving the research activity as a partnership rather than simply as a encounter that comes and goes. So I think in the end, this is really not anything really but healthy to have a clear idea of what the potential risks are. It's not a trivial undertaking, by the way, to obtain this kind of personal information. And so it's not a thing that is highly likely to occur in many cases. But people need to go into research with their eyes open. And if this helps open eyes and creates a better dialogue with the investigators, I think in the long run, it'll be as much a good thing as anything else.
Dr. Bruce Korf is a medical geneticist and chair in the Department of Genetics at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. His paper titled Genetic Privacy in the Information Age appeared in the August 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Still to come, when choosing a college or university, expanding your universe makes the choice that much harder. We'll explain next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1245. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. One of the toughest decisions a student has to make is choosing which college or university to attend. When they expand their horizons past the borders of their own country, well, the choice becomes that much more difficult. Jasmine Ramtula has their story.
Paris, London, LA, Chicago.
A private college education for an American student can cost more than $40,000 a year for tuition alone. For about the same money, a student could study abroad and get to see other parts of the world. 2 years ago, Kate Bartoseg, a graduate student from Michigan, was faced with that decision.
Yes, I applied all over the country and to England.
But after doing lots of research, she chose American University in Washington, D.C.
England, it will be more expensive because you don't get federal student loans. Those would have been really high interest rates, and the actual fees for an international student turn out to be a little bit more if you figure out the exchange rate.
International students are also faced with the same dilemma, but many of them know exactly where they want to be. Sinem Bakar is a native of Turkey who graduated from Catholic University. She's now the Assistant Director for International Student Services at American University. Sinem always knew she would end up in the United States to pursue her own higher education.
U.S. educational system at the higher education level is still one of the best. The entire world is aware of that.
She sees clear advantages for international students studying in the U.S.
They know that with an American degree, they'll be able to pay that easier than many other degrees.
For many students, the high cost of college is the deciding factor when choosing a school. For Americans studying abroad, tuition is generally cheaper than it is here in the U.S., where college costs continue to rise. The College Board says American students can expect to pay anywhere from $90 to $1,238 more for this year's tuition.
I don't think anyone in the 60s and 70s wouldn't have been leaving schools with anywhere near the size of the burden that they do now.
That's Jen Brandt. She recently put her niece and her nephew through college in America. She says when you compare incomes and the cost of inflation to steadily rising tuition costs, it doesn't add up.
The kind of burden it places both on families and on graduates, it really is extraordinary these days.
Yolaine Sico teaches French at l'Alliance Française de Washington. A French citizen who's lived in D.C. for the past year, Yolaine points out an important difference between France's system of higher education compared to the American one.
We go from the principle that the education should be free for everybody, and that's like something that has been taken for granted for a long time. We have a very nice social security system where pretty much everything is reimbursed. We really don't pay anything.
Still, many French students, like Johann Jean Solez, choose to pass on that free education and come to the U.S. to study instead.
I really wanted to study here in America. I'm studying international business, and America is kind of an important place to be.
The Institute of International Education notes that foreign students contribute almost $13.5 billion to the American economy every year. The Commerce Department describes U.S. higher education as the nation's fifth largest service export. Yoshi Hakigi is from Japan. When he enrolled at American University, he knew the burden he was taking on.
I have to pay tuition for international students, so it's much more expensive.
But for him, it's worth it.
My major is international studies and hope to work at the United Nations.
In 2006, the group Open Doors found there were more than 500,000 international students enrolled at U.S. colleges and universities. But what about Americans who go abroad for their studies? Open Doors says more than 200,000 U.S. students studied in foreign countries last year. Samantha Jensky attends a university in Switzerland. Her expenses range from $40,000 to $50,000 a year.
My other option was a university in Washington, D.C., which would have been $50,000 as well. But I felt like studying there would have made me a more well-rounded person.
American University's Sinem Bakar strongly recommends that students pursue their education beyond the borders of their own country.
The world is becoming global. I mean, there is no way that they refuse to learn about another country or culture or language and still expect to be very successful in their career. Coming to another country and getting an education really expands your horizons. You know, you learn a lot. And I think this is the most important gain.
The options facing high school students, who are my age, appear to be more complicated than I originally thought. We can stay in the U.S. and pursue the education that so many international students are anxious to get, or we can study abroad and take part in a unique experience. The Institute of International Education says although nearly 80% of Americans believe an overseas learning experience is important, just 1% actually pursue one. Samantha Jensky strongly encourages international study.
I feel like at some point every American needs to travel abroad because instead of boycotting French as mustard, which is actually American, we'd know that the foreigners are not as evil as we think they are.
Open Doors recently found that 87% of American students between the ages of 18 and 24 can't locate Iraq on a world map. During the coming school year, millions of students like me will be applying to colleges and universities, both here and abroad. I believe I've found the perfect one for me, St. Andrews in Scotland. They speak English, so I won't be too homesick, but it's also a different culture. I might even return home wearing a kilt and playing the bagpipes. For WAMU 88.5's Youth Voices, I'm Jasmine Ramtula.
Heavy industry and ecotourism are both in the business of making money, but the similarity usually stops right there. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. It might seem hard to imagine a way to reconcile the interests of environmentalists and the energy industry. But as Veronica Davidov, assistant professor of anthropology at Monmouth University, reveals, there are places where the two have arrived at mutually beneficial arrangements.
An ecolodge down the road from an oil pipe or an open pit mine next to a national park sounds like a strange paradox, but in reality it is not. I study how ecotourism and resource extraction, so oil production, mining, logging, coexist in the same landscapes. My colleague Bram Buescher and I edited a volume of ethnographic studies showing how such situations arise. Academic research has usually focused on ecotourism and resource extraction as opposite and incompatible. Instances where they converged are imagined to be temporary tense situations where eventually one type of industry will prevail. But reality is more complicated. First of all, increasingly, ecotourism and extraction projects are funded by the same institutions. Often oil companies themselves create ecotourism or other conservation projects around their concessions to comply with environmental offset policies or to maintain an image of a green corporation. Secondly, the idea of ecotourism at odds with extraction may only be in our minds. All around the world, locals participate in both industries often at the same time. For them, it's all a part of making a living. For example, Quechua Indians in the Ecuadorian Amazon, a popular ecotourism destination, have worked for oil companies since the 1930s. It is oil roads that bring tourists into the rainforest today, and many Quechua have labored both in the oil fields and in the forest as eco-guides. Some Quechua communities use computer centers built by oil companies to create websites for their ecotourism businesses. At the same time, many villages in the area were motivated by unfair labor practices and oil spills to become politically active and to choose ecotourism as their primary pursuit. Similarly, in Intag, in the Ecuadorian Andes, it is precisely the threat of mining that inspired a flourishing ecotourism project on the same land. The relationship between ecotourism and resource extraction in Ecuador and beyond is not simple, but it demonstrates that these industries do coexist and how their convergence, or nexus as we call it, affects local people can vary dramatically.
That was Veronica Davidov of Monmouth University.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.